Philosophy is one of those topics that one can spend hours talking about. I suppose it makes sense how the ancient philosophical thinkers used to spend days sipping on wine while discussing all sorts of subjects that piqued their interests. Personally, 2 years of reading, listening, and learning is merely a drop into what's an ocean of what this field entails. Regardless, what I've learned in the past 2 years have affected me in a way as meaningful as one can ask for. One core principle of any philosophical school of thought, whether that be metaphysics, epistemology, logic, or history of philosophy across Eastern and Western regions, is this question of certainty, whether anything is known for certain. Many ancient philosophers believed that true wealth is knowledge, and that knowledge is never ending. My experience with philosophy has been limited to what I've been exposed to, the books I've come across, the podcasts I've listened to, and the people I've spoken with. One of the many areas that has intrigued me is the academic side of philosophy. What students in universities learn and when they enroll in courses of philosophy. When I was a student, I wasn't quite as interested in the subject as I am now. Otherwise, I probably would have enrolled in a course myself. But a lot of philosophy on the internet is based off historical scripts, memoirs, and books by philosophical thinkers and writers who have shared their way of looking at the world. Whether or not this holds similarities with the academic side of things is a matter of discussion. So to expand more on this topic, I'm looking forward to inviting my guest today on the show. Gwendolyn Dolsky teaches philosophy at Cal State Polytechnic University in Pomona. Few of her courses include The Philosophy of Sex and Love, Moral Theory, and Existentialism. She's the author of Tips from the Professor, A Guide to College Success. Her podcast, Good is in the Details, is committed towards towards the art of dialogue and a passion for discovering ideas. And in the spirit of Socrates, the show aims to learn what we didn't know. So thank you so much for joining me today, Gwen. I'm glad to have this conversation with you.
I'm looking forward to knowing what you've exposed yourself to in philosophy, in addition to talking.
Yes, it's.
I'm so curious for the non-philosopher, for somebody outside of academia, what is it that you? I'm sorry, this is your show, and I'm already
No,
asking questions.
please go
What is it
on.
that you consider to be philosophy?
Yeah, it's definitely a question that has multiple answers. And so I'll share a little bit about what I've experienced over the past couple of years, which, as I said earlier, is only probably a drop in the ocean of what this subject entails. So when I first came across philosophy, I learned that it was divided into a few different subgroups that kind of broaden it up about what the whole field entails, which is what I mentioned earlier. So you have theoretical philosophy, you have practical philosophy, you have logic, and then you have the history of philosophy. In theoretical philosophy, it's more about the epistemology and the side of things as to why, asking questions about why things are the way they are, whether or not something is for certain. Then you have practical philosophy that talks about more how we should live our lives and what it takes to live a meaningful life, what it takes to be more fulfilled or to have better relationships. Logic asks things about, how do we differentiate between what right and wrong is, and how does that in turn affect our morals and ethics and values. And then you have the historical side of things that discusses many different schools of thought. We have Eastern, Western sides of philosophy, we have European sides, we have Indian, Asian, all these different regions that have had their own share of philosophical thinkers over the past few centuries who have shared their view on how they've lived their lives in their societies and what we can learn from them in the modern age today. So, dividing all of them into different areas, I found myself leaning towards the first two to start off with, the theoretical side of things and the practical side of things, because those were a little easier to comprehend and apply in my day-to-day life. The first experience I had was with the philosophical school of thought of Stoicism, which was introduced by Zeno in Eastern Europe many centuries ago. And the core element of Stoicism was, of course, a few ways of looking at life and perceiving things around us, such as knowing what's within your control and what's not within your control, learning to be more empathetic towards your fellow human beings, because that in turn would help you live a more contented and fulfilled life. And then after Stoicism, I found that the one thing that attracted me to Stoicism in the first place was that, and this applies to philosophy in general as well, is that philosophy never imposes this idea of this is the way that you should live your life. This is the only way. I found that a lot of the times, and we see this in books and videos and everywhere where someone's trying to sell you an idea, such as here's five ways for you to make more money, or here's five ways to live a better life, here's five ways to have a better relationship. But the idea behind that is that how do you know for certain that that one particular way or those five ways will apply to everyone? It might have worked for someone or for some people, but each of us have a different set of experiences that have shaped us who we are, and it just can't be a one size fits all approach for everyone. Philosophy doesn't embody that. It's like, this is how the ancients live their life. This is what you can do. Apply it and see if it works for you. If not, then you can take certain elements from it and make up your own decision. I found that it really made me think about what I truly believe in, what my values are, and then connect it to what the philosophy was trying to say, and then act accordingly. That approach felt a little bit more at ease with what I want to do. It didn't feel like I was being pressured by anyone, or that if I don't do this, then it's going to affect my life in any meaningful way. So that kept me going and learning more about philosophy in general. And then, of course, everything else came after that. Of
I
course,
love that.
yeah, that's how I saw it.
There's a lot that you've got in there. That's a really great description. And I think that one of the values of philosophy is enjoying our lives, and that thinking for its own sake is part of that activity. That reflection, it's a uniquely human thing, the way in which we can engage in the world. It's what makes us different from every other animal. And when we have, I mean, the level of reflection that we have, when we sit down and think that that in and of itself is the joy. And I don't think pay enough attention to the significance of enjoying our lives, because when we have that as the foundation and we understand that that is the core, then all of the other things fall into place. But none of the other things, business, relationships, what you're going to do on the weekend, none of that really works unless you are enjoying your life. And so one of the things when you're saying subjectivity and there's different ways that we can get into is there some sort of universal thing that all of the branches of philosophy and even theology, is there some truth that they have all come to despite the different areas of the globe in which they are thinking? And I think yes. Believers in God, non-believers, East, West, that there seems to be this central idea that when you pay attention to the activity of the mind, and that could be the soul, or that could be your character, just in case somebody doesn't believe they have a soul or an afterlife, that when you value that more than, let's say, the body or physical possessions or fame, when you prioritize your character or your soul or your mind, that will lead to a better life. And so it's important, like you said, when you see in marketing, when people are trying to sell you on things, this will make you happier. If you have a strong sense of what will actually make you happier, then you're going to be able to pay more attention to what business is doing.
Right.
And your pocketbook too, your checkbook also will be, your bank account will thank you.
Yeah. I agree with that. As someone who studied marketing, it's something that I had to internalize over the past few years about how marketing works and how you play to people's emotions and psychology and really appeal to their needs and in some ways appeal to them finding out what they never knew they wanted, but appealing to them, like this is what you didn't know you want, but you want it. And when people fall for it, it's not because they're just gullible people in general. It's just because they sometimes probably haven't looked deep down enough as to what they truly value, and they seek that happiness or that validation from outside, which is what drives them to, seek certain materialistic pleasures, like whether that be fame or wealth or success in that sense. But as you correctly mentioned, if we are able to look inward and reflect on everything we've been through to this day and find happiness in that, then everything else is like the cherry on top of it. That is just going to make it even better and better. It's not going to be something that we have to do. Like, I need this to be happier. Because the problem with that is that when you do get it, what's next after that, right? It's like it's this concept that my friend told me about called the hedonic treadmill, where you want to go faster and faster, but the more you faster you go, the more you're gonna get used to what your current speed is, and you're gonna even go faster and faster. Like I'll be happy when I have a family and kids. I'll be happy when I'll have $1 million in my bank account. All of that can happen tomorrow, and if it does, will you still be happy? But then there'll be another thing that you want, and another thing. But when you find that inner happiness inside, there's nothing else that can make you even happier. It'll just be an icing on the cake. It's like was just thinking about this like a few days ago. It slipped my mind right now, but it's more of when you find peace inside and happiness inside, then, and when you know that there's nothing else that can attract you in that sense, that you have no desires, then you can consider yourself to be incredibly powerful within, because there's no one who can manipulate you or no one who can tempt you with anything, because you know what your values are. And that's something that I feel a lot of different philosophers over the past few centuries have shared and talked about, and in different ways, in different languages, in different time periods. But it's like they've all embarked on this path that has eventually converged into one destination or destiny. So
yeah, my friend, I remember when I was studying philosophy when I was an undergrad, and one of my friends, James, who was a year ahead of me, and we were reviewing philosophy, studying for an exam at some cafe, and James and I are still friends. He was actually recently on the podcast because he's an Asian American history scholar. So anyway, we had James on, but I've been known him for years. And I remember we were studying, and I was looking at all of my notes and all of the problems that need to be memorized for the philosophy exam. And I think it had to do with the existence of God, whether or not God existed. We had to study those arguments. And I remember looking at James and just saying, don't you ever wish you didn't know what you know? Like, life would be easier it was so much easier to just have belief instead of seeing the complications with that belief. I said, it's just so confusing. And he said, yes, but you're confused at a higher level. And I've always remembered that that's what philosophy does. It doesn't necessarily solve any problems, but sometimes you can appreciate the complexity in which you are thrown.
Absolutely.
And acknowledge that there's a problem, because sometimes people who are the most secure about what they think they know find they're less likely to be able to evolve or find wonderment in the world. But when you recognize with humility that you're still learning, you're an eternal student in a way, then I think you can get more joy and get more surprise, or realize there's more places to travel, more books to read, more people to talk to, more food to eat. There's so much in that humility and curiosity, they go together. There's so much more joy in that than in thinking you've found an answer.
Absolutely. You put it in a great way. And I feel that people can come to that realization in multiple ways. It doesn't have to be reading philosophy to understand that that happens. Some people spend their time traveling and they get humbled by the experiences they've been through. They've visited certain countries, experienced certain cultures, met new people, and it makes them feel that, look, I had no idea this is how this part of the world works. And I was so closed-minded in my approach to think that what I've experienced is all there is, but then traveling around made me feel this way. I've seen many people who have traveled and have that's changed their life in that way. Similarly, you can be someone who has met new people in your own hometown and learned about their experiences, and it's humbled you. It reminds me of this paradox that I read about that went like, the more you know, the more you realize how less you know. And that's, I feel, what philosophy does. It exposes you to questioning and learning more about basic things that we just never gave it a thought of. And then, as you said, makes you more confused at a higher level, because you know for certain that this is not what I knew, but it's interesting because I can't look at it the same way anymore. I have no choice but to question it. Which leads me to ask you, tell me about what you teach as part of your job. So you have your PhD in philosophy and you specialize in epistemology as well. So what you teach?
I think one of my favorite classes, well, no, I'll feel bad if my students are listening to this. I love all my classes.
Yeah.
But right now, what I've been working on is a class that's called Philosophy of Sex and Love, and that you mentioned in the intro, and I got that class by accident. My background is in existentialism. My background is in moral theory. And the professor who had been teaching this sex and love class had to take a leave, and the chair asked if I could step in and take the class, and I said sure. And then that professor was unable to come back, and it became mine, and I was in a bit of a panic when I first started teaching it, because it's not my area of expertise. But I just absolutely fell in love with it, and it made me feel like a student again. I had not thought about sex and love or debates about sexuality in any serious philosophical sense. In fact, I think maybe I had a bit of a bias that love is about, you know, it's for the poets, it's for comedies, it's not, or for when you're very in despair and writing some crappy love song, you know, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
And I had to really sit and think, how am I going to put this together? And I started off with a book by Plato that's called The Symposium.
Mm-hmm.
And I read it and reread it. And I had read it in undergrad, but I had to revisit as, you know, a 40-year-old academic. And I realized if the concept of love was important enough for Plato to write about and to explore, then I need to pay attention to this. And maybe it is more serious. And so I had to question my own assumptions about what I thought the role of love was. And in The Symposium, it's about nine drunk men gathered together, and they're all going to stand up and give a speech on love. And
I would have loved to see that.
Okay. Yeah. What's that?
I would have loved to see that happen in real life.
Yeah, yeah. No, they're getting drunker and drunker as they each stand up and give a speech. And you realize, as I'm reading it, I'm realizing that there are different ways of reading The Symposium. Mm-hmm. But one of the ways that I was thinking about it was that each speech, the reason why wine is involved is that maybe Plato recognized that, unlike other philosophical topics like does God exist, or what is justice, or what is right and wrong, what is real, that the subject of love maybe requires us to let go of reason. Maybe a bit of inebriation is helpful so that we can kind of let go. Because if I were to tell you this is the definition of love, it probably would not be satisfactory.
Mm.
It just probably wouldn't. And that each speech represents a different avenue of love, like the type of love that one has for country, a soldier, the type of love that one has of what's of more value when you fall in love romantically with somebody's mind or their body. What's the conundrum there? What is love of wisdom? There's all these different ways to look at love. And I was thinking, maybe it's not just about love itself, but maybe it's also the different stages in one's life. You experience love differently. As becoming a new mom, I understand love differently now. Mm. That's just true. And I'm sure that when I am 80, I will understand love in a different way. So as of right now, this is probably one of my favorite classes because it has kept me on my toes. It made me think and rethink what is the role of understanding this profound experience of human life.
Right.
And looking at it philosophically is what's the significance. Mm-hmm. And there's legal expressions of love, who you can and cannot marry, right? Things like that. What is the age of consent? What is a violation? Love shows its way in culture, in media, marketing, yeah, right? All of that. What is love of self, love of other? There's the business of love,
mm-hmm,
dating apps, all sorts of things like that. So that's now on my radar as my favorite thing to talk about. Sure.
A few different points to address there. That's so profound. I think when we were growing up as kids, we had a different idea of love. And as you said, that perception towards love will change again and again, whether that's through, you know, 20-year difference or even a 20-minute difference. When we were kids, we had a different idea of love based on how our parents raised us and how our friends and family were. When we entered into high school during those adolescent teenage years, we had a different idea of love, mainly the romanticist idea of love and intimate relationships that made us feel what love is in that general sense. And then you grow up and you find different things that you love. You might love your family or your kids or your career or your passion and love for your country, as you said, that drives different decisions in your life. And you see that love is everywhere in that sense. It's not that, again, that simply limited to, it doesn't do justice to love to just limit it to that idea of intimate relationships, that's what love is, that you have to find a soulmate. That is a definitely a part of it, but that's not nearly what the whole concept of love entails. And again, it's hard to define love because it means different things for different people. But when you understand that, you feel that love is like this giant magnet that's attracting everything and everyone towards it, that's causing us to behave in a certain way. So I really like the way you mentioned that. The other thing you mentioned earlier is existentialism and moral theory. Could you expand a little bit on that? What moral theory, in what sense do you talk about? Because that's really interesting to me as well.
Moral theory is essentially taking a look at the definitions of right and wrong,
mm-hmm.
independent of context, which is hard. And it almost seems intuitive, what is right and what is wrong. But when you really sit down and think, what is the difference, it gets tricky. It seems like such a simple question.
Yeah.
But I would say philosophy, just in general, what we do is we talk about things that don't occupy space. That's the one way that I describe it to my students. So for example, I know it's a podcast, but if I hold up my reading glasses and we have a discussion of whether or not these are here, it's a very short conversation. We can use the five senses to determine and agree that they're here. Mm-hmm. It would be rather boring to debate it. But if we're going to have a conversation about what is the definition of right or what is the definition of wrong, that's a much different conversation. We cannot use the five senses to come to any conclusions. Mm-hmm. So the concept of right and wrong is actually more complex. And we, in that class in moral theory, we read the strongest thinkers that have provided definitions for them. And then in the class, we'll talk about, which I hope is fun, but we'll talk about films that have to do with the morality of issues. Mm-hmm. Things like superhero films are great for this. Yeah. Iron Man, the dilemmas of Batman, we're going to be talking about Black Panther. Is there really a hero or a villain in that?
Yep.
And that really good films, you'll notice that they have some sort of a moral center to them when, like, a superhero film. Mm. Otherwise, they would fall apart because that's what we're the most fascinated by.
Mm.
And so we talk about things like that. What is right and wrong absent of context? And then as the world changes and we get more technology and we learn more, it might make us question what we thought was true about right and wrong. So right and wrong is also evolving. So in my ethics, let's say in applied ethics, I teach engineers. And so we'll talk about new technology. Engineering ethics used to be about, here's a building, some engineers screwed up and people died because it fell apart. Don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the issue anymore. Now it's about privacy. Now it's about the impact of social media. Do we know what we're doing by keeping people addicted to this technology? How are we altering behavior? What about autonomous vehicles?
Mm-hmm.
What if they have to make a decision of if they're going to hit the old lady or hit a kid? Like, how do they make it? And who programs it? And then who's responsible?
Yeah.
So now engineering ethics is also genetic testing, right? Mm-hmm. Let's just say you submit your DNA because you want to find out about your histories, your family's history, genetics. People will find out that they're not related to the mm-hmm. people that they thought they were. They have some new relatives. Maybe they're not the same ethnicity or race that they thought. Some people are finding out they're part Neanderthal, which is also interesting, making us question the history of genetics. And then also legally in the United States, do the police have the right to tap into that data to find a killer? Now, there's no laws about that yet
mm-hmm.
because the technology is too new. So a lot of times with technology, it outpaces existing law, which means that our concept of right and wrong has to kind of catch up and really understand what these things are doing. And to me, that's a lot of fun to talk about. Again, it keeps me on my toes. Because technology is constantly changing. Discussions about sexuality are constantly changing. So we always have very fresh conversations in those classes.
Absolutely. And I think that goes to say a lot about how the world in general has, in a way, embodied a part of philosophical thinking into question everything they've known to be true over the past few centuries. In the past, it was very simple about knowing what you know. This is what two genders are. This is what the technology is. This is what's possible. But now anything is possible because they have questioned us to believe what there is to be true. There's so much going on in my head right now. I'll try to remember everything. Technology and right or wrong in technology. The first thing I think about, Gwen, is the metaverse. What Meta is planning to do with the metaverse. So what Meta's trying to do is they're creating this artificial world called the metaverse. Yeah, using AR and VR. And what that's going to allow people to do, this is a very simplified way of putting it, but it's going to allow someone to put on a set of glasses and enter this world and space where they can be whatever they want and do whatever they want. We have people buying land in the metaverse now, buying property in the metaverse now, using cryptocurrencies and stuff. And on one side, you might think that it's a good thing. It's going to help people because it's going to improve human well-being, which is what right is often defined to be. But then on the flip side, if you question it a bit more, you'll see what kind of detrimental effects it can have on society, because people might be using it as a way of escaping their real life, something that they may not be satisfied with. Someone might be living a life that they may not be happy with in terms of their career and relationship, and they might look at the metaverse as a way of escaping that reality by being whatever they want, doing whatever they want. And I feel that that would hinder our ability to make real relationships with each other, because we would just constantly be addicted to staying in the metaverse where no one knows who we really are. We can do whatever we want. We can live a different life altogether. That reminds me of a movie, as you mentioned, called Ready Player One. I'm not sure if you watched it, but really, really good film. I would highly recommend science fiction about a similar concept to the metaverse, where someone enters this world and lives in a certain way. But in real world terms, it sounds like a scary thought. And you can go on to question all you want. Like, on one side, you can admire technology for coming this far, but on the other side, you have got to question what it's going to do to society. It's a constant dilemma. One of the books I've been listening to recently is called The Moral Landscape by Sam Harris again. And he goes on to question what morality is, what right and wrong is, and whether we can have morality without religion. So he says that a lot of the times morality can be defined as how you choose to think about human well-being. You know, that if you're doing something right, it's because it improves a human's well-being mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and emotionally. That's what he classifies as being good. But then again, he goes on to talk about how our sense of morality is highly dependent on our experiences, what we've been through, context, as you said, and a little bit of genetics. But the majority would be experiences. That's what I've come to believe as well, in a sense that everything we know and what we believe to be right or wrong depends on what we've been exposed to over the past, how many of years we've been alive, how our parents have raised us, and the content we've consumed, the people we've been around, that shapes our understanding of what's right and what's wrong. That might completely differ to someone else who's been raised in a completely different environment. For someone who is living in a less privileged background where they don't have easy access to food, shelter, and money, for them, the sense of right or wrong could just be to survive. They might think it right to steal or to take someone's life if that means to provide for their own family, because that's how they've been raised. And that's when you get interesting and question about, you know, that person's idea of right or wrong is different to mine. What if I was in that person's place, would I be thinking the same way? And how does that conflict with what I've been raised towards? And then you get into thinking about how that affects law and punishment as well, and certain questions about what we should do as a society. He gives a great example about if you have two buttons in your hand, and one button can, if you press the button, it'll find a cure for cancer. The other button can permanently end racism for everyone. What button would you press? These kind of questions get you to think about what we should do and why. For some people, they might not be able to find an answer. For some people, they might be able to say cancer or racism. But again, that would depend on what you've been through. For someone who's lost someone dear to them due to cancer, they might find it important to press the cancer button. For someone who's been through their fair share of racism, they might find it more important to press the racism button, because their experiences have led them to think that. It's not that one is more important than the other. It's about what your experiences have shaped out to be. These kind of questions get you to think about the importance of context. So it's quite interesting to think about what life would be without any context. It's hard. Context can change everything. You might think of someone on first glance, like see a news headline, and we see this in marketing and journalism all the time, where we read about a news story, you know, like some person, like a couple had a fight, and the woman or the woman, for example, left the family or applied for a divorce or cheated on him. And you might think on first glance that it's the woman's fault, but then you go a little bit deeper and you find context that she did that because the man was domestically abusing her. That's what drove her to make that decision. And then you think about morality and how your perception towards this woman's actions changed because of that little addition of context. And it makes you more empathetic towards knowing people, because you know that there's always something deeper. There's always something hiding that you don't know about. A lot of stuff goes into moral theory. It's very interesting.
One of the big questions is, where does the moral worth of an action lie? Is it in the intention, or is it in the outcome of the action?
Right.
Or it sounds like you might be thinking it's a little bit of both, which I think I think a lot of law gives some leeway to.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, was it the intention? Like, you know, if somebody gives you a crappy gift for a holiday,
yeah,
and you say, well, it's the thought that counts, then your moral understanding is in the intention. But if you just look at it and say, this is a crappy gift, then you're more outcome oriented.
Right.
But yeah, moral theory. I mean, one of the other things about Sam Harris that's really interesting is that since he's in neuroscience, and I've kind of toyed around with this idea of the more we're learning about the brain, that the idea of the mind or the soul is not a non-physical thing, but is a physical thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. Sam Harris would definitely think this, that this is his camp. But in the same way, running, the activity of running is an expression of, let's say, the quality of your legs and your lung capacity, mm-hmm, and how you can get to be a better runner through exercising those physical parts, or become a terrible and slower runner by not exercising them.
Yeah.
The same thing is with thinking, that it is a brain activity. So for example, anyone who's bilingual, they know that if they're not using one of those languages, it gets weaker, kind of like the runner who stopped running for a while and then tries up again.
Yeah.
And it is a strange thing because we're accustomed to thinking as a non-physical thing, but actually it is. And this gets to the moral issue, is that empathy also is a key ingredient to morality. A person without empathy, and empathy is located in the brain, we're talking about somebody who's psychotic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they have got lack of empathy is scary. That people kill for that reason without any remorse. So what I've been wondering, and this is driving me nuts, what if evil is actually brain activity? That it's not a choice. Like in the same way we talk about depression, right?
Mm-hmm.
When somebody says that they are depressed and they go to a physician, they can get a prescription because the depression is actually not some mental, non-physical state, but it has to do with chemicals in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
What if evil is like that?
Mm-hmm.
And what if we can do genetic testing when somebody is pregnant? And in the same way we do the genetic testing to see the health of the baby, or if there's any kind of a problem, what if we were able to say, and your baby's evil? Like, what if we were able to do that?
Right.
I don't know if your listeners are going to think I'm crazy.
Mm.
But I am interested in Sam Harris's position, and the more and more we're learning about the weight of brain activity and that our feelings and our moral choices are the result of the neurons firing in our brain.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is a weird thing to think about, too.
It is very weird. And he goes deep into that in this particular book. So if this is something that interests you, I would highly recommend check out The Moral Landscape. He addresses this point in a very interesting way, Gwen. He says, as you asked, what if there was a way to cure evil? You know, if we could have a pill, if evil was just a nutritional deficiency, if we could just have a pill as part of our diet that could cure it, what would that mean for society? And he says that could lead to certain societal dilemmas. Like, for example, if you have a killer on the loose, yeah, and he's murdered someone, would it be unethical to deny that killer that pill to cure evil? Or if that pill was available to the killer before he did the murder, would that change the way his punishment is decided? Because that person could have decided to cure himself of that evil, but he didn't. But maybe it's because he wasn't provided that solution, because it must have been withheld by a company. If a pharmaceutical company sells evil pills for a high price, then that might limit people from buying that and curing themselves of their evil. And it goes into questioning about what that would mean for society and how that would shape our perception towards this particular person. And as you mentioned, psychopaths are one example where you have to understand what's driving them to behave in a certain manner and why they don't feel that empathy that everyone else does. Is it just as simple as saying as they've just been through certain experiences in their life, like they've been raised by abusive people or in a drug or a poor environment that this has driven them to behave in this manner? Or is it something innately wrong with their brain and the brain function that has caused them to behave in this manner? And it's difficult, and it's interesting to question it, because then you ask, what is evil in general? You know, what classifies as evil? Like, if you look at Hitler, for example, was he just innately evil, or was there something different in his brain function that caused him to behave in this manner? And it's difficult to think of an answer, but it makes you more accepting towards people and questioning before you make a decision. Like, if you think of a terrorist, yeah, the first thing you think of, like an ISIS terrorist, for example, you think of them as a bad person because they've gone around shooting people, or like a mass shooter. But then if you give them the benefit of the doubt for a minute and think about what they might have been through, it's possible that the terrorist could have been separated from their family when they were really young, put into a group of extremists who have raised them in a certain way, taught them about their religion or their people and the culture, about how everyone else in the world is against them, and that the only way for them to do good is to avenge whatever lives they've lost and to kill these people who are bigoted or who are against what they're doing. For that terrorist, they might be thinking that they might be doing the right thing. They might not have the idea of good and evil. They might not think about human empathy, because for them, that empathy is for their own people, not for the other people. So they are feeling it in a certain manner. But then you question, is that really evil? Is it their fault? Can you blame them or no? But still, we collectively have this idea about what good and evil is, and it's shaped our society in certain manners, shaped the law in a certain manner. It's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard.
When in my intro to philosophy class, we were just covering these discussions about... Oh, wait. Do you still have me there? Because it looks like...
Yeah, I do. I do. Is it frozen?
Okay. I can hear you.
Can't see me?
I just want to make sure you can hear me, because our screens are frozen, but if we can still hear each other. Okay.
Yeah.
But in my intro to philosophy class, we were just talking about this debate about determinism, mm-hmm. and free will. And there's something very humbling about Sam Harris's approach, because you do, in the way that you're talking, you do recognize that there are so many things that factor you into you, mm-hmm. that are completely out of your control. And the year you were born, the family into which you were born, the body into which you were born, all of these things, your first language would dictate the way in which you understand and communicate in the world.
Yeah.
And not all words are the same. There are words that exist in one language that don't exist in another, which means that the thinking is not there. So when you have an appreciation for that, it allows you to give people grace and have some humility in trying to figure it out. And the thing that drives me crazy about the determinism versus free will argument is that there's a part of me that wants to hold on to the idea of free will.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I choose, I act freely. But
yeah.
Whenever we are trying to understand something, like in the United States, if there's a school shooter, or a situation like with terrorism, or if somebody commits suicide, we want to know all the causal factors. We don't believe that is just free will. We want to unwind and figure out why somebody did that. So we use determinism, which is Sam Harris's point of view, to understand the world, but we still want to think, but our actions are free.
Mm, mm. Yeah.
And it's hard.
It is hard. One of the things he comes down to, of course, knowing that it's hard, is that, yes, determinism might be the leading factor behind everything. Like, everything's fated, or everything has a set due of course. But that doesn't mean that our actions don't have consequences, or that those consequences don't matter. What we do matters. Whether I choose to do what's right now and follow my day-to-day schedule, or if I choose to go and kill someone, it doesn't matter. Saying free will doesn't matter, is an illusion, doesn't negate the consequences that I have for my actions, because those consequences will in turn affect my life in the future. What I do today will in some way, form or another, affect what I do the next day and the week after that. It bundles up because of the determinism. And it will in turn shape what I'm constantly doing as well. So actions have consequences, and he talks about consequentialism, that everything has consequences. And again, that ties into the idea of moral relativism as to knowing what's right and what's wrong and how we determine that, which to some extent is intention, but also consequence. Now, knowing, feeling that free will is an illusion is difficult to grasp. It took me two times, listening to his book twice, and reflecting on it for a good month or two to really think and reflect as to whether or not I can believe in it. But I found that after a point, I had no choice. I had no choice but to believe in it. And until my mind has changed, I have no choice whether or not that will change as well. So it's humbling. And as you said, it makes you more understanding and empathetic towards humans around you. Like the random guy in front of you who comes into your store or into your workplace who's annoying you or is bugging you is not because he's genuinely a bad or annoying person. It's because of how he's shaped up. And knowing that makes you understand why people do what they do. If you look at people who are addicted to social media, and this was big during the lockdown past couple of years, where they hadn't had a lot of time looking outwards and meeting other people, they had no choice but to stay inside. And of course, we need to do something. We can't stay still in a room. It's impossible. Anyone who says they can stay still and do nothing need to be put in a room where they have no activity, no phone, no TV, no internet, no bed. You can't sleep. You can't eat nothing. They would go crazy in like half an hour or so. It's not possible. So during COVID, we had this heap, you know, big part of society who had their phones to look after. And that's fine. But what that did it is that exposed them further to social media where they're looking at influencers. They're looking at people outside living their life in a certain manner. And, you know, that fear of FOMO does hit in sometimes as to, I'm sitting here, why don't I get a chance to live like that? Why don't I get a chance to get all this fame and this popularity on social media? I want it as well, because they may not have looked inwards and found what they truly value. But then it's easy to say that you're just addicted to social media, you know, you have nothing else to do. This is how you are. You're just seeking external validation. But that's the experiences that they've been through throughout. It's not them innately doing that. It's just what they've been through. It's a lot. It's a lot to take in. And
it's designed to be addictive.
It is designed to be addictive, yeah. And you can say that the companies are doing the right thing in their sense because they know how to, you know, sell their product or make money. But then can you question whether or not that's good for society? Because the people who are on those apps are doing it willingly. They're not being forced by any way. It is consensual, but then it's affecting their life in a significant manner as well. So can you question the company for doing that? Or can you question the people for doing that?
I think, okay, that's a good question. I think it is addictive, and it's intentionally addictive, and people are using it not knowing that it is addictive. I like cigarettes.
Yeah.
That for a long time there was not this awareness. The companies kept it a secret that it was actually designed to keep you addicted.
Right.
And that social media is doing that. Now, if it seems dramatic that I'm saying, linking that with something like cigarettes, we do have studies to show a decrease in self-esteem, decrease in concentration, and increases in self-harm, bullying to the point where people want to kill themselves. These are young people who don't know a different world other than social media. They don't know it.
Yeah.
And this brings me back to Aristotle and even the beginning of what we're talking about when it comes to what does it mean to live life well. Mm-hmm. And I always tell my students, and I have to practice this myself, I'm not on a soapbox waving my finger.
Yeah.
But I had to consciously do this. I will not look at my phone first thing in the morning, and I encourage my students to give it a try, and it is extremely difficult. I said, just do something else for you. And the reason is because when you get on social media or you check your phone for emails or whatnot or messages, you're doing one of two things. You are either looking to see what everyone else is doing, or you're checking to see what other people think of you. And neither one of those things are an act of contemplation or enhancing your own life. That is completely hooked on things that are not significant to your own spiritual, intellectual growth. So whatever you do in the morning, I was like, I don't care if it's letting the dog out. I don't care if it's a yoga pose. Maybe open a physical book and read for 5 minutes. Just whatever you do first thing in the morning, make sure it is for you and not something else. And I think we're stuck in this response culture you know, where we're constantly just checking in on our emails or what other people think and not taking the time to see what makes us, what makes us grow, what makes us happy. So I think that the social media thing, I think there's, we're like frogs boiling in water. Mm-hmm. And we're not even realizing that it is causing significant damage. Mm. I think it's causing real damage.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. But I would also argue that with any addiction, I feel a lot of the people, a lot of the addicts are aware of that. Like smokers are aware that their smoking is bad for them. People who are addicted on social media, to some extent, I feel they know that that mindless scrolling is not fun, but they can't stop it. And that makes them even more miserable sometimes. It's like the paradox of depression, where you're feeling depressed and you're feeling upset and anxious about the fact that I'm depressed and that I have no solution for this. So you get even more depressed. And that's the thing about addictions, as I said, is that sometimes you just can't control. And it's easy to say, you know, when someone's getting into an addiction, it's just because they want dopamine. That every cigarette you smoke, every new like you get on social media, or every shot you take of weed, you just get a hit of dopamine. But keep doing it and the dopamine sensitivity starts to reduce. You become resistant to dopamine and you need more and more. And we see this with everything, even with sex and porn as well, right? It's just the dopamine that keeps piling up. And you know that you're getting addicted to this, and you know that you shouldn't do it, but you still do it. Are you still at fault there? And can you blame the object itself? Can you blame the cigarettes? Can you blame the porn? Can you blame the social media? Because it is damaging. It is damaging. Mm-hmm. But then can you question someone's mental fortitude or their will? Not free will, just their will in general as to being able to resist it or not. Because there are some people who don't get addicted. Some people can have a cigarette or two and not get addicted. Some people can have a non-addictive relationship with social media and sex as well. Is there a difference between those people and the people who do get addicted? Does it come down to mental fortitude? Because the product is the same. It's how different people respond to it. Or is it just a matter of how much of that product are you exposed to? Whether it's having one or two cigarettes or having five cigarettes or 10 cigarettes. Does it come down to the quantity? Does it come down to how much time one person is spending on social media versus another? It's hard. It's hard.
I spoke with, this is one of the guests that we had on the podcast, Dr. Reverend Angela Gorell. And so she has a background in theology. She's a reverend. And she wrote a book called Always On that was about social media. Mm-hmm. And from a theologian's point of view, which was really fascinating because I would have never put the two together. But she had done a lot of research, and I guess one of the differences between, let's say, cigarettes and social media is that there is such a thing as an okay and even healthy dose of social media as opposed to cigarettes. There's no such thing as a healthy dose of that. But she was, in her research, she was saying it has to be a limited time and you are happier when you engage with other people, and that means actually leave thoughtful comments. Mm. And so if somebody's having a post, take the time to congratulate them if they're celebrating something. But if you just hit like or you just scroll, you're less likely to have a good experience with social media. So there was something about an amount of time. And she also said that if you are not happy, and you are posting on social media pretending to be happy, you are less likely to get happier. You're actually going to get worse. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was interesting because I can see that logic in that if we are constantly putting up this shield to show everyone that we're okay, and then that further removes us from our own feeling and then our ability to reach out to let somebody know we're not okay. You know, these very, very human qualities of being vulnerable, of being embarrassed, of having a bad day, having bad hair day, like saying the wrong thing. I mean, all of these very human qualities, we're trying to erase them because they make us uncomfortable when actually that's partly what makes, with our friends and our family, that's what makes us love them. It's not all their perfections. It's the entire thing. And so we're trying to run away from it and create on either dating apps or social media this perfect image of ourselves and maybe afraid of what people will see if they know that we're not perfect. So we distance ourselves, don't let anyone know when we're actually having a hard time and we need help. I think there's a lot wrapped up in it.
There is. I am going to play devil's advocate here and add a question to that. Is that if you're a member of the audience and you're on social media, and as you said, you want to support someone if they've shared something vulnerable about themselves, how do you know whether or not they're doing it because they want support or whether or not they actually need that? And how do you know that you showing them support will actually help them, or it's going to just provide them validation that they didn't know they want? Someone might post a picture of themselves that they would have taken 1,000 photos of, you know, take a photo of me, didn't go well, take another one. And they're trying to find that perfect photo because they feel that the perfect photo is what will get them the likes and comments. So they post a photo and you feel that you're being a good human being and we say something nice to them. For that person, would it be as easy for them to just believe that what I'm writing for them is genuinely what I believe? Or would they think, is this person really being genuine? I haven't, you know, spoken to him in a while and he's saying something nice. On one hand, they might believe me and they might get that momentary bit of happiness, but they might crave it again next time when they post another picture. On the other hand, they might not believe me, and that might make them think that I'm not being genuine, or that what they were wanting to get out of that photo upload is not what they're getting. And so does it become a cycle? Can it be that if someone's really vulnerable, so if, for example, if someone shares something tragic that's happened, like you've lost a loved one or something really, really bad has happened, then you show support because it's not something that happens often. Yeah. But in general sense, like stuff like a bad hair day or, you know, just felt cute, might delete later, those kind of features. You see, it fascinates me to see the way people respond to that, because I don't see anyone talking to each other in real life like that. Like you see someone's photograph, whether it's a guy or a girl, usually the young people, and you see the comments, chain of 40 to 50 comments about favorite, God, you go, awesome, you know, this is beautiful, you're the most beautiful, and each photo is the same thing. You can't have each photo to be a favorite. You can't say the same thing about each photo, because that reduces your compliment to something that's superficial. You don't generally mean that for someone. Whereas if you meet someone in real life and they're looking good, you tell them, and you tell them again, and you can believe that what they're saying is real, because it's not easy to lie to someone's face, but it's very easy to lie on text or on social media. Can you question the authenticity of someone on social media? And if you can or you can't, what does that say about your perception towards that person and your relationship with that person?
Now I'm wondering, now I'm trying to think back to that interview and some of the things that she said.
Hmm.
I know that talking to her definitely impacted me, that when I'm on social media, I avoid the scrolling. So yeah, I wouldn't recommend that somebody be disingenuous on there. But I would say if somebody said they got a job, or if somebody just go ahead and take a photo of, you know, what you love, if there's a beautiful landscape,
mm-hmm.
or there's a book, and you are right. I mean, I noticed with my own social media feed that when I post a photo of a book, for instance, mm-hmm. and I am a book nerd, mm-hmm. reading is my favorite activity.
Yeah.
So when I share, which I do every once in a while, a book that I'm reading, it gets very few likes. I share a photo of myself, I get a lot more likes.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just the way that it happens. Same thing with the podcast social feed, or, you know, Instagram. When I post clips of our interview, they don't get nearly the same amount of attention mm-hmm. as if I post a photo of either myself or my co-host, Rudy. So I don't know why that is. I don't know why it is. But I think that we definitely need to be aware of the way in which we're spending our time. Is it a time filler? Because like you said, I mean, I have a 15-minute break between my classes.
Mm.
If I have two classes in a row. It used to be, before the smartphone, you just walked from one building to the other. You
could
get lost in your own thoughts, wave to people on campus. Now everybody is using the phone as a time filler, and I don't think that that makes you feel good. And so I'm trying, since lockdown, that when I have a break between classes, to not get on my phone, but I'll practice a yoga pose or two between, so that I am fresh for the next round. And I think the biggest thing is awareness of how you're feeling.
Yeah.
That's a conscious. Yeah. We act in an unconscious way. We just do habits. We don't even think about it.
Mm.
How's that? What do you think?
That's good. I commend you for being able to do that.
I'm not the best at it. Like I said, I get sucked into it too. I mean, especially with podcasting, and then you got podcasting, you've got work, and then so that includes a little more social media and things like that. So it's like I check my inbox hoping that there is something to do with these things. And adding the podcast onto that layer of my life in the last couple of years means I am on social media more, because there's partly the job of promoting the show.
Yeah.
So it is very easy to get lost in it. And I have to remember for my own sanity of that I enjoy reading and I do enjoy podcasting, and I have to focus on the content more than I am worried about what other people are responding to, so that I can continue to create good shows.
Yes, yes, that's amazing. And as I said, I commend you for that. I feel, Gwen, that the reason you're able to do that is because you have spent a bulk of your life reflecting on what you like and really like, and you've found it and you're comfortable with it. And it's not something that a lot of people have. Like, going back to like a seminar or a lecture where you have people taking breaks between classes and on their phones, it's because going on a phone is easy. You don't have to talk to anyone. You can be whatever you want. Even if you, you know, don't know anyone, you can just go on social media and look at stuff and you can get a dopamine hit. But not doing that, on the flip side, means what? You might have to speak to the person next to you who you don't know. You might feel shy. You might be worried that you might say something you don't like or they don't like. You might be worried what they might think of you. You might worry about saying something stupid. Otherwise, there might not be anyone next to you. You might think about sitting alone and what people will think of you of that. As we discussed earlier, it's not easy for someone to sit there doing nothing. We need to do something. We need to feel a purpose or to do something. Sitting alone in one lecture full of people, not doing anything, is not easy unless you've familiarized yourself with that process of being with your own thoughts. And so we, as a way of escaping, go to our phones. Now, you can do whatever you want on your phones, whether it's checking emails or checking social media, but still, it's not easy to do that. And again, knowing about putting good content is something that I'm trying to do as well. And so, I commend you for doing that. What I felt with my podcast a while back, and this was towards the end of last year, is that I was getting to the whole creating content that other people will like and find interesting. But at the same time, I was foregoing what I really like about my show, what I started, and the quality I felt went down a bit. And I didn't measure that by how many likes I was getting. Like, yes, the likes I was getting initially when I was putting good content were higher than the recent ones, but that wasn't the reason I felt that the quality was deteriorating. It's because innately I felt that this is not what I like. This is not what I want to do. Give it a bit of a revamp, and now I'm trying to focus on topics that I like, because I've been able to reflect and become more comfortable with knowing what really is Akash and what drives me to talk and certain things. And like this podcast itself, this is what I wanted to do, and I feel that it's going really well.
I give that advice to podcasters too, what you're talking about, and that takes a while, I think, to get comfortable with your own content and just believe the stuff that you yourself are interested in. Go for it. Because otherwise we would just be recycling what everybody else thinks that they want. You have no originality. And I remember, I think it was my third episode in, I did it solo, and I was at an academic conference, and there was a woman at this conference who was a scholar on Simone de Beauvoir.
Oh, yeah.
Now that is one hell of a niche in philosophy itself, yeah, let alone the world. And I emailed her in advance. I had read some of her work, and I said, I'm going to be at this conference. Could I interview you? I have this podcast. And she's Professor Emeritus, and she's an older woman. She didn't really know what the podcast was or what I meant by that. She said, how long will it take? And I said, oh, just 10 minutes, lying through my teeth.
Ten minutes.
I knew I wanted more, but I figured if I could just get her, you know? Well, I met her at the conference. We go into another room, and she still seems a little bit wary of what is all of this about. And then when I hit record, she is the only American scholar that I think of who worked with Simone de Beauvoir.
Oh, wow.
Margaret Simon, when she was in grad school, she had heard about Simone de Beauvoir, and she picked up and she went to France to meet Simone de Beauvoir and work with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my point is that I remember thinking as I was talking to her, this woman is a gem. I wanted to know, what was it like to meet Simone de Beauvoir? I wanted to know. And I did this wholeheartedly because I was fascinated and I thought, nobody's probably, I don't know if anyone's going to be interested in this. I don't know if many people even know who Simone de Beauvoir is, but I love reading the works of Simone de Beauvoir. This woman, actually met her. This is a gem for me. That episode got retweeted more than almost any of our other episodes.
Yeah.
Because other people who like Simone de Beauvoir in that niche, they were the ones who were retweeting it and retweeting it. And I'm so glad that I went with my gut and I didn't worry about what was popular or who has a blue check mark on Twitter and that's who I want to interview. But I just went with something that I found fascinating. And yeah, so I would say for you or for anyone else there podcasting, you have to go with what you find interesting because that energy will spill over and other people will be excited about what you're talking about.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. That's an incredible point to make. Which makes me want to ask you, speaking of research, and again, the academic side of things, what are some of the assignments or projects that you give students in terms of philosophy? Because we've spoken a lot about what you talk about, and it's a lot very interesting, but how does it work when it comes to assignments and projects and essays? What are the kinds of stuff that you give them to do and work on to make them think? I'm curious.
Okay, yeah. So what I've done recently, I want to say maybe in the last 3 years, 3 to 4 years, there is a plagiarism problem because of the internet. So it's very easy for students to copy and paste stuff. And honestly, I'm tired of checking for it. And I had to be more creative, you know, and I really think this also for people who are in education, when people get complained about students, I just want to say, look, we also have a responsibility too, to be engaging. It's not all the student's responsibility. So one of the things that I did was I started assigning students that they could pick something from the syllabus that they thought was interesting, and they needed to find a newspaper article from a major news source, and it didn't even have to be an American news source. It could be something like The Economist or Le Monde or something like that. And an article that's been published in the last year that has something to do with the topic. And I am getting the best assignments. Like right now I'm reading an essay written by a student that is talking about Socrates' trial and Socrates' choice and choosing justice over risking his own life and did a comparison of the president of Ukraine to Socrates. So the students are looking up contemporary issues. And they, I tell them, you don't even have to agree with the article. I just want to know what is in the news right now about technology, about the rightness or wrongness of actions, about sex and sexuality and love. When you find those buzzwords, what is being written about it? And use something from our class to analyze it. And ever since I started assigning things that way, I'm getting the best papers. And I don't have to worry about plagiarism anymore.
I would love to be, I would love to read some of those assignments and see what students today are talking about. I had this, I mean, I still do, like a few days ago, I was thinking about talking to my university and the student central over there about being like an assistant tutor in either a philosophy course or a business course, because I want to see what the current students at the first years and the second years are studying. And I feel so old saying this, even though I'm only 22, because I just got out of uni. But I want to see what other people think about this topic, because as you said, it sparks creativity, and you want to see what different people think about what you think about as well, because it exposes you to different ways of, you know, perceiving things. But that's really interesting. And I feel that you would have seen the rate of plagiarism drop because of that, because people are more concerned about what they believe and they take pride in writing what they believe, and it just flows naturally. They don't worry about, oh, it's 3,000 words, it's too much. Nah, 3,000 words about a topic that you love is less. Take it from someone who writes blogs, it's nothing. And you can go on and on about it.
I mean, for my sex and love class right now, I mean, I don't know if it's news where you are, but it's definitely big news here in the States. But there's this obsession with the Johnny Depp trial.
Yeah.
Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. And so some of my students were writing about that. And it was so fascinating because they were talking about the underscore and presuppositions about who gets abused and how that was being used. And what is the body language or the ideas about sexuality that were playing into everything that's going on with the trial.
Mm.
And so it was just, you know, the students are fascinating. They're thinking, and they're thinking about the things in the news right
now. Yeah, yeah. It does make its way here, over here as well. People love to talk about it. Another thing that came...
Oh, the Johnny Depp trial?
The Johnny Depp trial, even a few weeks ago with the Will Smith Oscar event, what happened there.
Oh, yeah.
That was a big, big issue as well. Everyone had their own opinion on that. And I'm sure you would have seen some students talk about that as well.
We did. I invited it because when we talk about moral theory, we have different thinkers who are defining what is right and what is wrong. And so I actually had the students pick a philosopher. They had to get into groups and make the case of the rightness or wrongness of the Oscar slap using Aristotle, Immanuel Kant, or John Stuart Mill.
Oh, wow. Wow. Those are three very different ways of thinking. Wow. I would have loved to see what the person who aligned with Immanuel Kant had to say about that. It's, yeah, up for debate, up for discussion, definitely. It's funny how we can apply a lot of what we've been passed down from ancient philosophers into today's world. It makes you think about, you know, they weren't that crazy back then. They had something to say, and things haven't changed even though the world has changed. Humans at their core are still humans. Things we do are still the things we do. Just in a different environment.
Yeah, I mean, Aristotle, I have a soft spot for Aristotle. He did, and his work really rang true for me. I enjoy a lot of philosophers, but I enjoy teaching Aristotle in particular. I like the ancient Greeks because I really like the way in which they approach character development as the foundation for living life well. And Aristotle talks about this concept of eudaimonia, which means it's a Greek word that doesn't really have a very good English translation other than happiness, but it can mean flourishing and excellence. And Aristotle answers this question of, you know, what is the object of life? Why do you do anything? And eventually you get to this notion of eudaimonia or happiness, and it's the only thing that's for its own sake. Everything else is, you know, like, why did you get up? Or I'm going to do this. Why do you get a job so I can pay this bill? Why do you want money so I can travel, I can do this? And then eventually you get to, well, what do you want that for?
Yeah.
Happiness, eudaimonia. And I think that, and I try to do this with the podcast too. That's why I think I selected the good is in the details, because I think that enjoying your life and thinking and all of these things, they come back to happiness for its own sake, and finding that in different avenues, different professions, but there's this underscoring drive of what it means to be and to kind of have this solid idea. And the great things about the ancient Greeks is that it turns out that psychology has actually supported what they figured out in the ancient Greek world, that what makes you happy really are these non-materialistic things, and that they can now have the data to support that, to demonstrate it in scientific terms, that people are happier when they engage in ideas, creativity, ideas of justice, and friendships.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. I was having a conversation with a colleague of mine a few days ago about what it would be like to live forever. We were just chatting about, I think, movies. We were talking about movies, and it came to vampires and werewolves and... So you were talking about this idea of what would it be like to live forever? Like, if you just stopped aging at 25 or 20 and just never aged another day, you would never have to do anything. And I asked him, would you be happy with that? And he said, yeah. And I said, okay, what would that be? And he's like, oh, because you don't have to worry about anything. You can just do whatever. And then I and another friend of mine questioned him as to, yeah, but then what would you do? What would you, like, why would you do anything? Like, why would you need to eat or make relationships or work? It would have no reason behind it. You would not enjoy anything. And it makes you think about why we do things in life, as you mentioned, for happiness. As to we know, or we've somewhere in the back of our mind know that our life is going to come to an end. Whether that's in 50, 60 years from now, or it could be tomorrow, we know that it's going to end. So we want to live this life to the fullest. And I don't think someone who lives forever would be happy with that, because they would not be able to form a meaningful relationship with anyone. Everyone they love would pass away, and they would still be there. They would probably be the wisest person ever, because they would have lived through all centuries and seen all through humanity and seen what everything is. So even if they wanted to, they would probably not be able to find love in anyone, because they would just be too young for them. What do you think?
You know, so back to Simone de Beauvoir, she wrote a novel that toyed around with that idea called All Men Are Mortal. And there's a character who drinks a potion to live forever.
Oh, yeah.
And the way in which this main character interacts with the world is that it makes you appreciate the fact that we exist in time.
Yeah.
And that when you remove that element of time, when you remove aging, that is actually an issue for the main character. He cannot find love because it would be an inherent asymmetry. The way in which a woman would love him would be radically different than the way he could love her, because once she's gone, he'll find somebody else. Whereas for her, she would give her whole life to him. So that inherent asymmetry would make any relationship impossible. And he also couldn't experience courage, which is a very human thing. But courage means that you are risking your life.
Yeah.
You're risking something. So a lot of the things that make life valuable is this recognition that we're fragile, that we break like anything else. It's, you know, it doesn't take away meaning knowing that we're going to die. Like, even a lot of people who have childhood pets, and when you lose a pet, it is devastating. It's so emotional and awful to lose a pet. And yet a lot of people will buy or get another pet. Why? We know that what that emotional pain is when they're gone, but that's not the determining factor of whether or not you can love this being while they're alive and how great it makes you to feel.
Yeah.
And so loving and engaging in the world, experiencing courage, a lot of the excitement of it is because we know that our time is limited. We know that. And so sometimes we forget it, and that's when we end up wasting time. But it can really add it adds the dimension to what it means to be human. In other words, you remove the concept of time, you are no longer a human existence. We can't even fathom that.
Yeah, yeah. Reminds me of a quote that I came across, is that life is not short, it's just we spend too much time living it the wrong way.
I like that.
Simplified way. That's really good. I think we can wrap up the episode right here. It's been such a pleasure chatting with you. We've spoken about so much. It's been you know, over an hour, but it feels like nothing. Just flew by.
I love it.
It's been really great.
This is my favorite thing. I love talking about philosophy. I can nerd out on it. Yeah. I absolutely love it. And I love what you're doing, because I don't want, for me personally, I really do not want philosophy to be an ivory tower thing. I think that the real spirit of philosophy from the ancient Greeks and the existentialists is interaction and dialogue with people. And so I really appreciate you having me on the show, and I'm glad that you're doing this project, and I'm glad you discovered philosophy too and you're liking it.
I'm glad as well. And I can't wait to just keep learning more and opening my mind to even more possibilities. Maybe next time we chat, we'll have a totally different conversation altogether. So I'm really glad we have had a chat, and you know, thank you so much for joining me once again.
I'd love that.
Beautiful. So I'll, for everyone who's listening, I'll be linking in Gwen's podcast and links in the description below. Please check out her podcast and show as well. I'll also be writing out a blog, the blog for this episode. So if you don't want to listen through, you can have a read on it. But thank you so much for listening, and I'll catch you in the next one. Thank you.